Good morning. It is Thursday morning, April 14th, 11:15 a.m. And we're doing Chem 12A. This morning, we are continuing our look at the substitution reactions. The SN1 reaction is where we've been. So today we're going to take a look at, let me go ahead and do a screen share. Let's get started here. And we'll talk about where we're going to go with this. All right. So what we did was a few comparison reactions before. We were looking at the SN1 reactions, so that we're continuing on with SN1. What we looked at so far were the rates and the reasons for these rates of reaction that we said that tertiary was far faster than secondary, which was faster than primary in terms of the substrate. And we went into a lot of reasons for that in the last lecture. We talked about all those different reasons. And in addition to those different reasons, we showed a number of examples, and we said that there are things that are faster than a tertiary substrate. So for instance, these SN1 reactions, because they go through a carbocation intermediate, and that's the key phase here, is that they go through carbocation intermediate, that we can get things that are things like allylic, which is going to be greater than a tertiary, which is going to be a whole lot greater than secondary and greater than primary. So we have to watch out for all those other factors that we have talked about before. So watch out for all of the stability factors. Okay, and so today, what we're going to do is we're going to look at how molecules can adjust in order to become more stable. So sometimes when we have a secondary center or a primary center that develops, the reaction can rearrange. Let's take a look at an example. Let me show you an example of what I'm talking about. So for today, what I want to look at, let's start with this reaction. This is an alcohol undergoing a substitution reaction using HCl and heat. And what we would expect for a product out of this is that we would expect the chloride to substitute in the exact same position where the hydroxide comes off. So mechanistic-wise, what happens here is the proton is picked up. We create a good leaving group. Hydroxyls themselves are not good leaving groups, but once you protonate a hydroxyl and you turn it into an oxonium ion, now it becomes a good leaving group. That group comes off, leaving behind a secondary carbocation. And then the chloride comes in and attacks that, leading you to your product. I'm going to put that arrow quite so close. And that product is about a 30% product in terms of the product ratio. In addition to that product, the major product of this chemical reaction happens to be this one. This is the other 70%. And you ask yourself, well, how did that happen? If we take a look at where things are located here, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, it's 1, 2, 3 either way. So we would go this way, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And finally, 1 out there, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And the question is, how did the chlorine get on carbon number 2 if the carbocation was initially here? 1, 2, there's carbon number 3, 4, and 5. The carbocation was on carbon number 3. So how did that happen? Well, what happens is this part. If we take a look in greater detail, there is a proton that sits here on carbon number 2. And that proton can shift, taking its electrons with it. It breaks the electrons away from carbon number two. And in doing so, what it makes is a more stable carbocation, which is on carbon number two now. So numbering again, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And so we can see now that that hydrogen has shifted. And if I keep track of where that hydrogen is now located here. So let's just highlight it, that that hydrogen has shifted from carbon number two to carbon number three. And the reason that it did that was because this was a secondary carbocation. Now we're at a tertiary carbocation. Now the chloride can come in and attack that carbocation, and leading us to the major product. So this is called a 1-2 hydride shift. And that 1-2 hydride shift, what it's saying is that the hydride is shifting from one position to the second position, and they can only be one carbon apart. It's not a 1-3, it's not a 1-4, it's a 1-2 hydride shift. And that 1-2 hydride shift goes from a less stable carbocation to a more stable carbocation. So let's take a look at that energy diagram and see what's really happening there. In terms of the energy diagram, for this whole reaction, I think I've got enough room to do it in here. We start off with the alcohol. The alcohol then gets protonated and goes to a lower energy state. We go to the secondary carbocation, which is fairly high in energy. And then we come down to the tertiary carbocation, which is lower in energy. And then we come down to an overall product. So let's see if I can connect these the way that I like to. And it may not do it entirely, but then what I can do is I can copy and paste them, and I can move these around. So it looks something like this. There we go. Okay, so we start off with the alcohol over here and the HCl. We go to the protonated form of the alcohol, where the alcohol is now a good leaving group. This is lower in energy, because the HCl represents a very high energy state where the HCl is a stronger acid than the protonated oxonium ion. That group leaves, and we leave behind the secondary carbocation. So water is now a part of this, as is the chloride ion. Then we have the hydride shift taking us to the tertiary carbocation. As we said, water and chloride ion are still apart. And then we have the final product over here, where the chloride binds to that tertiary position, and water was the leaving group. And what's going on is this step.
Do hydride shifts exist in equilibria?
Good question. In general, no, we don't think of them as existing in equilibria, but it depends upon the exact reaction conditions. So there are certain acids that we use to explore hydride shifts and alkyl shifts. And those acids are extraordinarily strong acids, which makes the carbocations extraordinarily long-lived, and we don't give them a nucleophile to react with. In that sense, what we do is we look at carbocation movement or 1-2 hydride shifts over and over again throughout a molecule to find the most stable carbocation that can be found. This is how we do carbocation studies. So yes, you can make it in terms of an equilibria if the right conditions are used, but in most reaction conditions, no. In most reaction conditions, it's sort of a one-way direction. And the reason is that you're going lower in energy, and that to go backwards, you need to climb over the activation energy barrier in order to go back to the secondary. And there's no reason to do that. There's no energy stabilization that's gained by doing that. And so generally, we're going down to lower energy. And this isn't a complete energy diagram. As you saw before, there were two products that came out of this. So 70%, this major product is where the chloride is on the tertiary center. 30% is where the chloride is on the secondary center. So where did that secondary one come in? It comes in over here. There's another reaction that we can look at. I guess I could try to fit it in. It never works well to be able to draw these in after the fact. Also, I don't know if I can get that to snap in the way I like, but this would be the formation of that chloride in the secondary, stemming from the secondary carbocation. And what happens is the activation energy for the hydride shift is just relatively low. And because that hydride shift is relatively low and going to the more stable secondary carbocation, that turns out to be the major product in that. How does that hydride shift actually happen? Let's look at what's actually taking place in terms of that hydride shift. So when we look at the hydride shift, we've got a carbon. Let's call this 1-2 hydride shift mechanism. We've got a carbon that is the carbocation. This has the empty p orbital. Adjacent to it, we have a carbon with a hydrogen, and this one is tetrahedral. Remember that I'm going to put R groups in here. Let's say that this is R and R prime. And this represents the carbocation. Remember the mechanism by which we said that an alkyl group stabilizes a carbocation. We drew a couple of different mechanisms. One of them was the hyperconjugation mechanism. In the hyperconjugation mechanism, we have the orbital, which is the sigma orbital, which is here. That sigma orbital is adding electron donation into that carbocation, as is the back phase a little bit. And so we're getting that donation into that carbocation. That donation means that that sigma bond is donating electron density to the carbocation. That weakens that sigma bond to begin with by stealing some electron density out of that sigma bond. And it's already sort of a shared orbital. What happens is that hydrogen is splitting its energy between, or splitting its electrons between the two carbons.
Are there any partial charges?
There are. We have, actually, it's not partial positive. It's partial minus, partial positive, and partial positive on each of the carbons. And if this center happens to be a secondary center, and this center a tertiary center, then in this transition state, in this movement of the hydrogen from one position to the next, it becomes more stable to support the carbocation on the tertiary center, and the hydride shifts. And that's why we call it a hydride shift, is because it is a hydride. It's shifting with its electrons. It's taking its electrons with it. And that's what a hydride is something that has a pair of electrons. And so here was the secondary center and the tertiary center. And now we have a tertiary carbocation. So this would be a secondary C plus. Now we're looking at a tertiary C plus. And that's that hydride shift mechanism. So it's not complicated, but the key thing here is that because the electron donation is only one carbon away, that we only see hydride shifts shifting once. And in addition, we only see one shift. Not multiple shifts. And only shifts towards more stable carbocation. So you'll never see a tertiary shift towards a secondary or some other thing like that, but it's only going to go towards a more stable carbocation, not a less stable carbocation. So we only see one shift. We only see a 1-2 shift. We don't see 1-3, 1-4, 1-5. No multiple shifts and only shifts towards a more stable carbocation. Now, in reality, do we only see 1-2s? No, sometimes we do see 1-3s and 1-4s, some other strange things, but those are different sort of reaction mechanisms that are outside of the norm of what we typically do. So we limit it to 1-2 hydride shift instead of these other things. All right, let's take a look at another reaction example. Let's say that we're starting with a cyclic product this time. This has a bromide on it, and we're reacting this with sulfuric acid and water. And heat. In this case, what's going to happen is the bromine is going to come off. This is our SN1 mechanism. We get the carbocation. Our nucleophile this time is water. We get the attack of water. We end up with a protonated oxonium ion. And then something in solution, presumably the bromide that came off, takes the proton back, giving the electrons back to the oxygen. And that leads us to our first product. That product is about a 40% product. The question is, well, is there any 1-2 hydride shifts that can occur in this? So I take a look at where that carbocation is. The carbocation is currently sitting on a secondary position. There is a hydrogen which exists there. There is the carbocation there. There are two hydrogens that exist over here. And so generally what we do is we take a look at this secondary carbocation and we ask, what is going on the adjacent carbons? So we take a look at the carbon over here and the carbon over here, and we say, are there any hydrogens that we could shift that would result in a more stable carbocation? And if I shift one of these hydrogens over, what would happen is I would be trading a secondary carbocation for a secondary carbocation. So that wouldn't get me any more stable. And there are no more hydrogens on the left-hand carbon or the top carbon. So there's no hydrogens that can shift over there. So then the question is, well, what happened to the rest of the percentage of this reaction? And the rest of it looks like this. And this is the rest of the 60%. The question is, well, where did that come from? How did that happen? And if we look at that, that's got a carbon rearrangement, that the carbon framework is no longer the same. And because it's in a ring system, it's a little bit easier to see that both carbons were on the same, both methyl groups were on the same carbon. The first product, both methyl groups on the same carbon, now both methyl groups are not. Now the two methyl groups are spread out. So what's happening here is that we can see that other groups can shift as well besides hydrides. That I can get the shifting of an alkyl group if I can get a more stable carbocation. And so that takes me from the secondary to the tertiary. And this is a 1-2 alkyl shift, oftentimes called a 1-2 methyl shift, but I like to say alkyl. Because methyl shift implies that only methyls can shift. And in reality, that's not true. Just about any alkyl group can shift, although the propensity of a group to shift is stronger when the group is smaller, just for energy reasons, that it's easier to shift a smaller group. And so once I get that alkyl shift, now the water can come in and attack this. And the mechanism goes forward as before. And then the last step is just a deprotonation step. So that's where that step comes in. And the alkyl shift looks exactly the same as the energy diagram that we did before. The energy diagram is really no different. This is a 1-2 alkyl shift. So essentially what we have is we have the loss of the leaving group going towards that secondary carbocation. We have the alkyl shift, which takes us to the tertiary carbocation. And then we have the attack of the water, taking us to the protonated oxonium. And then finally, the final product. And so I had the bromide, secondary, alkyl shift, oxonium ion, and then the alcohol. There we go. So there's that energy diagram. And again, that idea of coming down in energy to a more stable carbocation through some type of shift, either hydride shift or alkyl shift. And the mechanism for this shift looks much the same as it did before. That idea that when we had a carbocation and that carbocation is being stabilized by a sigma bond, now having a CH3 group as the sigma bond, these can be different R groups, whatever you want, and this is the carbocation, that electron donation from the sigma bond into the empty p orbital, which then that donation leads to the actual shifting. That donation leads to the transition state where the methyl group or alkyl group is bridging. And these are the R groups. R and R prime, and this is now partial minus and partial positive on each one of these centers. That is our transition state for that shift, and then the shift occurs. And then that takes us to the tertiary carbocation. So there's the mechanism for that 1-2 alkyl shift. Now, looking for hydride shifts and looking for alkyl shifts, what is it that I need to do here then when I'm presented with a problem? Let's see how complicated this can get. It can get really complicated really fast. Therein lies the problem. So let's take a look. And let's look at an example problem. Alkyl shifts and hydride shifts. Hey, come on. So what if we have a problem where everything is sort of on the table? Cyclic molecules are good for these because it makes it easy to see what the change is. When you do a linear molecule, the change is a little bit harder to visualize because there's so many different ways to draw it. And that takes me to one of the single biggest keys here, that when you start to draw these things, do not rotate them or change the representation in the way in which you draw them. Keep everything as consistent as possible, so that you can understand and make sense out of everything. The minute you start changing representations and twisting things around, that's where things go bad really, really fast. All right, so the key thing here is we're only going to shift towards a more stable carbocation, and we're only going to be looking at single shifts. So key thing, only shift towards more stable and second key, only shift once. Okay. So what products do I expect to come out of this? First off, the way that we need to attack it is we need to think about the mechanism here. This is an SN1 reaction. In order to make that hydroxyl group a good leaving group, I can't just pop the hydroxyl group off. Hydroxyl groups always work this way. They always get protonated. So we pick up the proton from the HBr. Once it's protonated, now that can become a good leaving group. Now that group comes off. Now I assess what it is that I have and what I can do with it. This is a secondary carbocation. That secondary carbocation, that initial carbocation, will always give you one of the products. So one of the products will always come from that one. So there's the first product. Let's call that A. So A, where did A come from? A came from the secondary reacting with Br minus. This is A. Or actually, let's not put the A there. Let's put the A underneath the product. And we'll kind of keep track of where all the products go. So there's A. All right. Now, what can we do with A? Is there any way to make A more stable? Well, what I do is I take a look at the positions that are adjacent. And I say, is there anything that I can do here or here that is going to lead me to a more stable carbocation? Those are the two spots to consider. And I should also pay attention to what is actually connected to these centers. I have two alkyl groups on the top carbon and an alkyl group and a hydrogen on the bottom carbon. So the first thing that I might consider is I might consider the hydride shift. So we'll say 1, to hydride. The 1-2 hydride shift, I'll do it in a different color here, is where I take and shift that hydrogen over. The 1-2 hydride shift gives me the carbocation now on the carbon down below, and the hydrogen has been moved to that carbon. So this is now a tertiary carbocation. And now that tertiary carbocation can be attacked by bromide, and I can get a product out of that one. Let's call that B. So there's another product that I can write. Okay, I've considered the hydride shift. If I think about this carbon down here and the methyl group that's here, I could consider moving that methyl group. But if I move that methyl group, it's going to take me from a secondary carbocation to a secondary carbocation. And so that's not a good direction to go. So I don't really want to consider moving this methyl group, because it'll take me to a secondary carbocation in this position, and that's already where I'm at. So then I'll leave this carbon alone, and maybe I'll consider this carbon up here. Now I could move one of the alkyl groups over and do an alkyl group shift, a 1-2 alkyl shift. That would take me from a secondary to a tertiary. So that's one that I should consider. So let's take and make this one in red. We'll do that one there. So this is a 1-2 alkyl shift. That's going to take me to a molecule. That's going to have the carbocation in that position. That's a tertiary carbocation. And then that can be brominated. And that is yet a third product, C. So let's get C in here. And then we have to ask, is there anything else that can occur? It looks like I've done everything. I've considered all the alkyl shifts. I've considered the hydride shift. It looks like I'm getting three different products out of this. The one thing that I would say, though, is that there's one more thing that we can consider. Let me show you. And I want to show you by redrawing this carbocation. And by looking at the carbon that's over here. So I want to consider this carbon. Notice that I have two groups here that are methyl groups, and I could look at the shifting of either one of those methyl groups. But I said that these are alkyl shifts, and there's another bond that goes to that carbon, and I should consider all three of those carbons. Now, the first two are the same. So when I did one, it would have been the same as doing the other. That doesn't get me anyplace. But this bond here, this bond could shift as well. And it can shift this way, shifting down to make a new bond in this position. This makes, without changing anything other than my connectivity, so that you can clearly see kind of what happened. Can you see the degree of carbocation that is formed when that bond shifted? Let me go through and number these really quickly. This is hard to see. Let's call the carbocation 1, 2, 3. We're not numbering for nomenclature, just numbering so that I can get a handle on things. 6 would be in the center. The carbocation that was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 is now connected to 1, and 6 sits there. If I clean that molecule up and make that molecule look a little bit better, we use an equal to symbol rather than equals. I use 3 lines that makes it a little bit more clear. This is now a 5-membered ring system. And on this 5-membered ring system, it has a carbocation sitting in that position. Numbering system has not changed. Numbering system is still 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 is the carbocation. And if you look at what degree carbocation that is, that's a tertiary carbocation. And that tertiary carbocation, after going through that alkyl shift, and so this is where we went here. We went 1, 2 alkyl shift. Now we can have the bromide come in and attack this, and we can get an additional product from this guy. And this is D. D being the hardest of those products to find. All right, so out of all those products then, how do I decide what the major product is in looking at all of these? That's a really important question. In looking at what the major product is, it may not be super easy. We would consider that anything that was coming from a tertiary carbocation would be the major product. And in general, the smaller the group that is migrating, the faster the group migrates. So if I'm looking at the smaller group migrating, then the 1,2 hydride shift would be considered to be the fastest. So a smaller group, faster. Now that's true if and only if the carbocations are all the same stability, really. But we would expect that that one would be major. That was by 1,2 hydride shift. And these other two, roughly equivalent, these are by 1,2 alkyl shift. And I don't have percentages to put on this to give you for this one, but we would consider the smaller the group shifting to be the major group in this sort of instance. Although there are other ones where we can get into interesting conversations. So hang on to that, because that's really important in trying to figure out what all of the products that come out of a chemical reaction are. And it's, I don't like my bond angle there. It's not trivial. It's not easy taking a look at some of these chemical reactions and figuring out where these reactions are going to go and what are the, how many products are going to come out of these reactions and where did all these products come from? And you can see that even just a simple reaction here leading to a carbocation can take you to a whole slew of products. And even finding them is complicated. All right, let's take a look at another reaction. This one's an iodine reacting with methanol and heat. So this is a sevalysis. Remember, all sevalysis are SN1 reactions. And sevalysis just means replacement by solvent. one of the key things that tells you that this is a sevalysis reaction, replacement by solvent, is that there is no nucleophile listed above the arrow. And so the question is, what is this going to do? It's an SN1 reaction, so let's follow it out. First thing is we knock the leading group off. We note that we have a secondary carbocation. From that secondary carbocation, we can get attacked by the solvent. So the first carbocation that you come from always leads to a product. It may not be the major product, but it always leads to a product. Let's use the iodide to take the proton, giving the electrons back to the oxygen, and that's going to lead us to our first product here. And then from that product, we want to ask, is there anything else that can happen? So we go back to this idea of the secondary carbocation. And we say, is there anything that we could get that would be more stable than a secondary carbocation? What else could happen here? So what we want to do is we want to consider the positions that are next to it. We want to consider the position here and the position here, alpha to the carbocation. When we look at alpha to the carbocation, one position away from the carbocation, we say, is there anything that can shift that would make a more stable carbocation? Well, if we shift a hydrogen, a hydride, from the right-hand side, we could get a tertiary carbocation. So a 1,2 hydride shift. Let's do it this way. Would take me to a product in which now I have a tertiary carbocation. What about shifting the other way? If I shift the other way, there's two hydrogens here. I could shift one of these hydrogens over. So this would be an additional 1,2 hydride. Let's say that this one that I just did was the blue shift. Let's consider this red shift. And in doing the red shift, I end up with a secondary carbocation. Or is it secondary? It is secondary. But if you look at it a little bit more closely, it has something that the other one doesn't have. It's resonance stabilized. This is a secondary allylic carbocation. And a secondary allylic carbocation is more stable than a tertiary. And so what we see is that this reaction doesn't happen so much. that the shift is towards the allylic position because of the stability gained in the allylic carbocation. And then once I have an allylic carbocation, now I have two different positions that I need to consider, which one of these gets brominated. And the answer is both of them. Or it's not bromine, it's iodide, right? No, it's methoxy. Not even halogenated. So let's say HOCH3. So both of these get attacked by the nucleophile, by the solvent. And then it was an iodide that came off. Yeah, so we'll use the I minus to take the proton. And we end up with the product. And the same thing over here. And then the question is, well, which one of these is major? Or even, what do I expect out of this? There's the two different possible products that can come from it. So those two products then wind up all the way back up here. And that guy. Okay, so those are the two products that wind up coming out of this. Out of these products, the first one is minor because it came from the secondary carbocation, and the secondary carbocation is just not that stable. These two would be considered to be major. And out of those two, we have an interesting discussion to have about the factors that are going on within those two. So in order to figure out which of those two are major, we need to understand some other things about products and about stability and about transition states. So as we go back to those two and look at those two, this is where we have the start of a discussion. Let's look at stability of double bonds really quick. Stability of alkenes. When we look at stability of alkenes, what we find is that the most stable alkene is an alkene that is tetrasubstituted. As you go to trisubstituted, they become less stable. Disubstituted, there are many different combinations of disubstituted that we can have. And those disubstituted have different stabilities depending upon their configuration. And then we can go to a monosubstituted and finally an unsubstituted. All things being equal, the more substituted, the more stable. It's a factor of a couple of different things. Number one, the tighter a molecule is, the more branching there is within a molecule, the more optimized the electron nuclear attractions are, and the more stable the molecule becomes. So branching oftentimes is a stabilizing factor, and molecules which are more highly branched are energetically more stable, thermodynamically more stable. That's part of it. The other part of it is sterics, particularly when we get into these disubstituted versus something that is trans versus something that is cis versus something that is geminal. geminal meaning on the same carbon, that we have sterics that play in there. And the less sterics we have, the more stable the molecule is. And so sterics also play a role. So the more substituted a double bond, the more stable a double bond is. That's one factor. The other factor has to do with the resonance. So when we look at the resonance here, and we look at the shifting over of the electrons, that we can say which one of these resonance contributors is the major resonance contributor, correct? You guys should be able to tell me, just looking at these two resonance contributors, which one is the major resonance contributor. This is a secondary carbocation. This is a primary carbocation. The carbocation takes priority in determining the stability of the resonance contributors. Yes, there's a difference between a primary double bond and a secondary double bond. However, the carbocation is really the thing that is influencing the stability of the resonance. And so out of those guys, the secondary is going to be the major. And what that means by having that be the major resonance contributor is that when I look at the molecule as a combination, a linear combination of the resonance contributors, what I see is that the resonance is spread between these two carbons, and that I have a small partial positive on the primary position and a much larger partial positive on the secondary position. And so what that means is that this is a larger nucleophilic attack. Now, sterics don't really play a role in this because these are all sp2 hybridized carbons. And because they're sp2 hybridized carbons, there's not quite as much sterics, maybe a little bit more sterics, but we have a large nucleophilic target. And a smaller nucleophilic target. In terms of coming into these, what we see is that there's generally a smaller E sub A for attacking that larger nucleophilic target because of the larger orbital. And there is a larger E sub A in attacking out at the smaller position, or at the smaller nucleophilic target. And again, it's not that sterics plays as much a role in this because they're all sp2 hybridized, and being all sp2 hybridized, they're all entirely flat. And so a little bit difference in terms of what's going on here. So when we take a look at the energy for these.
So wait a second. Is that carbon in the middle? Is that one charge neutral?
I wouldn't say that it's charge neutral, although it doesn't carry, it carries a partial minus charge as compared to these that are the carbocation carbons.
Okay.
But it's not a full partial minus. Remember that the whole molecule is carrying a full positive charge. So this is an image of what the overall molecule looks like. And that molecule is a carbocation. And so we're looking at the spreading out of the positive charge and where that positive charge is spread out amongst the two carbons.
Okay,
so typically what we see then, which is interesting in this energy diagram, is that if we look at the carbocation, and we look at the two resulting molecules that come from this, one of them giving a more stable double bond. Let's put that more stable double bond as the secondary double bond. and one being slightly less stable in terms of the double bond that is created. No, that was right. I just drew it in a funky way. So let's say that this energy is here. Actually, I'm going to lift that up a little bit. Let's lift this one up a little bit. These heights are based on the stability of the double bond. More stable double bond, less stable double bond. In fact, maybe what I'll do is say that because this double bond is secondary, that this double bond is more stable as the secondary double bond, as a disubstituted double bond. And then we have the transition states, the positions that wind up getting attacked. We said that the attack at this position here has a smaller E sub A. So in order to draw that smaller E sub A, and I'm going to apologize because I didn't think through my energy diagram as I was drawing it. I'm going to shove these out this direction. You'll see why in a second. I'm going to say that my smaller E sub A is going to hit right about this position, and my higher E sub A is going to hit in this position. So what I should be able to do is that if I ask my computer to do this, there's that small E sub A for the formation, the lower E sub A for that guy. And then I need to copy this and do that. Paste it. Ooh, ugly. We'll do it that way. That looks pretty enough. That gives me my higher E sub A. And that is what's going on. So what I have over here is I have lower E sub A. That's this guy. For attack at the large partial positive. And I have a larger E sub A for attack at small partial positive. And yet, when I attack that small partial positive, it goes to a more stable product. This is a less stable product. This sets up that perfect example of kinetic versus thermodynamic. This is what we had talked about when we talked about energy diagrams in the last chapter. And I alluded to the fact that for certain chemical reactions, that we can get a kinetic product and a thermodynamic product, this one being the thermodynamic product. It's promoted by higher energy in the reaction. So higher temps and longer reaction times will get me over the higher activation energy barrier. This one is called the kinetic product. The kinetic product is favored by lower energy and by faster reaction times, by shorter reaction times. And so depending upon what my reactions are set up as, this one is favored by low temp and short reaction times. This one is favored by high temp and longer reaction times. If the reaction conditions are not stipulated such that you really can't tell we generally go for the thermodynamic product as compared to the kinetic product. Also, when we go back and we look at the reaction conditions and the way this reaction was set up all the way back over here, we see this high heat. That high heat is going to push us towards the thermodynamic product. And we would expect the product that has the more stable double bond, and that was this one, which was the thermodynamic product, and we would expect that product to be the major product. Trying to figure out kinetic versus thermodynamic, when it's actually happening, when it's occurring in a chemical reaction, and then figuring out which product is the correct product, that's something that we're going to work on for the rest of the semester, that we will continually come back to. It happens over and over again, particularly when we look at elimination reactions. But for right now, what we'll say is that most of the time, we're looking for the thermodynamic product. I guess I used a coloring scheme here. I put red. Maybe I should change this and color this all blue, because that was the coloring scheme that I used before for the more stable. And then let me change that coloring scheme to match. That's more consistent. So when you go back in the notes and review that, you'll see kind of what's going on there. All right. Like I said, that's going to be a big topic that we will continue to work on. And so I don't expect anybody to get kinetic versus thermodynamic just yet. It's a very complicated subject. We'll review it over and over again. We'll keep bringing it back. Let me take a few more minutes and look at a couple of other reactions that can sort of support this. Let's look at this reaction. This is a reaction that is a sulfolysis reaction too, of sorts. This is the replacement of an ether. We're going to do this not just in water, but we're going to use acetonitrile as the solvent, CHCN. But then there's a co-solvent, water. And we're going to look at what happens. This is, again, an SN1 reaction, or all of these that we're looking at right now are SN1 reactions. As this thing pops off, we get a carbocation that is both benzylic and allylic, that there are two groups that can resonance donate to this. However, while this aromatic ring can resonate to it and is a resonance electron donating group, we will not see substitution on the aromatic ring during this reaction, because doing so would break the aromaticity, and the aromatic rings are really, really stable. So what we say is, do not substitute ring. They're too stable. We will find reactions later on that react with aromatic rings, but for right now, we're going to ignore the aromatic rings when they occur within a chemical reaction. So what we're really considering is the resonance. Even though there is additional resonance with the ring, we're really only looking at substituting the two positions that are not the ring positions. And so these are going to lead to two different products. And these products will be the substitution with water. I'm not going to do the full mechanism. We get the first product. And the second product. like that. So those are the two products that come from that. Let's do this one cold and given that the temp is cold, this is going to be kinetic control. Which means that I'm looking for the kinetic product. To understand which one is the kinetic product, I have to look at the two double bonds and I have to figure out which double bond is less stable rather than more stable. So when I look at the double bond, what I'm doing is I'm comparing the substitution pattern of the double bond. This is monosubstituted. The other one is trisubstituted. So mono versus tri, what I'm looking at is I'm looking at this here. I've got one substitution, one, two, three substitutions. So therein is my tri, and herein is my mono substituted. The mono substituted is going to be the kinetic product. It's going to form the fastest, but be less stable. The kinetic, I should do this by rate. I should do this. My coloring scheme is all off. I'm going to leave that as kinetic, and I'm going to leave this as thermodynamic. This one, the kinetic product, is going to be favored under these conditions. And as it's favored under these conditions, it's going to be the major product that's going to come out of this. So again, looking at that cold temperature, finding which one is less substituted of the double bonds, that less substituted one is the one that forms the fastest. That's the kinetic product. That's going to be the major product. Let me compare this to another reaction. In this case, I have the same reaction conditions, acetonitrile and water. And I'm also doing this one cold. So this one's also under kinetic control. So what happens in this one? In this one, what we see is that when that chloride comes off, it generates a carbocation. And that is also an allylic carbocation. And that resonance-wise, when I look at that carbocation, it's identical to what I had above. And you take a look and see, here I have the tertiary carbocation, I have a methyl sticking up, the double bond terminal, methyl sticking up, tertiary carbocation, double bond terminal. In the first resonance contributor, I have a primary carbocation, then the double bond methyl group sticking up, primary carbocation, double bond methyl group sticking up. These are exactly the same carbocations. And what I get out of this is I get exactly the same products. What this does is it actually verifies my model in that it doesn't matter what the starting position is. The reaction is governed by the carbocation that is developed. And the starting material doesn't make any difference in terms of, at least if they give the same carbocation. And so this one is kinetic major control over here. This one is major. And I get both of these as the same product. The K value relative for the formation of this thing is 2.5 times faster than the thermodynamic. K relative down here, I think this one's 4.1 times faster. Than thermo. And so the reaction actually runs a little bit faster in terms of this one, but, and I don't know where I got those numbers out of which textbook I got them, but they're within tolerances that they're both pretty damn fast in terms of that kinetic product being the favored major kinetic product. Actually, I do know where I got those. No, I got them in the Journal of Organic Chemistry. This was the year 2002. It was the volume 67, and it was page number 182 to 187. So there's the reference for that. One of the nice things that was in that reference too is this difference between kinetic versus thermodynamic control. Here's the other piece of that study that they did. They took this material and they looked at the equilibrium reaction in acetonitrile, reacting it with water. I think there was an acid catalyst, probably something like PTSA. And the formation of the thermodynamic product. And what they did is they let this run for a long time. Long reaction time. What that long reaction time does is it put it under thermodynamic control. And once you put it under thermodynamic control, now what we're doing is we're looking for the product that has the more stable double bond. It's not so much about the carbocation anymore. Now it's really about the more stable double bond. And trapping the product into the more stable double bond. That's this double bond over here. That's the thermodynamic product. And that product then, when they stopped the reaction, this had a 16:1 ratio, 16:1 product ratio. Where this one was major. So 16 times more of the product on the right-hand side than the product on the left-hand side when we put that reaction under thermodynamic control. Same reference, same Journal of Organic Chemistry reference. All right, so so that's a bit about the carbocations. And so looking at allylic positions and looking at once we get resonance and how resonance plays into it and how important resonance can be and how tricky resonance can be, we need to pay attention to what the reaction conditions are, whether the reaction conditions are under kinetic control, being cold and short reaction times, or whether they are under thermodynamic control, being hotter conditions and longer reaction times. And then we can appropriately pick the product. If we're under thermodynamic control, we go for the more stable product. If we're under kinetic control, we go for the less stable product. the less stable in terms of the double bond. And that's the way that we pick those out and resolve those. All right, the last topic in this, we don't have time for today, but I do have time to introduce it a little bit. The last topic is one of stereochemistry. What do we do about stereochemistry in terms of SN1 reactions? We looked at stereochemistry for SN2, and I'll remind you about the stereochemistry for SN2. So when we looked at SN2 stereochemistry, if we had a carbon that had a leaving group, and let's say that the leaving group was priority 1, and then this was 2, let's make this one 3, and that one 4, such that that's the lowest priority group, and the 4 group is in the back, then when I look at this and I draw this going around, I'll see that this happens to be an S stereocenter, that I'm going counterclockwise. If my incoming nucleophile is such that I undergo that SN2, that I go through the inversion of configuration, the carbon gets inverted. And now I'm not going to put groups on here. I'm just going to put partial minus. And let's say that the incoming nucleophile is going to take on the highest priority group. As it takes on the highest priority group, now the nucleophile comes in, attaches to the carbon. I have priority 2. This will be priority 1. 4 will still be back. 3 will be forward. And now as I put that highest priority group back, look at that, I'm swinging around in the clockwise orientation. And this becomes an R stereocenter. And we get inversion of configuration. What happens when we look at SN1? When we look at an SN1 stereochemistry, and again, we're just sort of introducing it here. Let's look at something that has a stereocenter in it. Maybe the hydroxyl leaving group. We have a methyl, and we need to be able to track. We need to put another stereocenter in someplace else in the molecule. So let's put another stereocenter in over here. And then we hit this with H2SO4 and methanol, such that what we're going to be doing is we're going to be protonating this, causing it to leave, create the good leaving group, that group pops off, and I get the carbocation. Okay, that carbocation, when I look at that carbocation, what is the geometry of that carbocation? The hybridization is that it's sp2, and that implies that it's trigonal planar. And being trigonal planar, that means that this thing, if I draw it this way, and I think about that carbocation as being flat, there's the other methyl group, which is going up, and the hydrogen, which is going down, and this is the carbocation, and this group is coming out towards me, and the other group going back away from me. Now, when the nucleophile comes in, the methanol, there is equal approach from the bottom as there is from the top. And because of that, what I wind up with is I wind up with two different products. I wind up with a product where I have attack from the same side of the molecule that the leaving group left from. This would be the retention product. And I get attack from the bottom side, which would lead to an inversion product. And I wind up getting both. And I wind up getting both in equal amounts or near equal amounts. There might be a little bit more sterics from the top side because of this methyl group. If that methyl group were closer, it would impact things more. Right now, it's pretty far away. So pretty equal opportunity from above and from below the plane in terms of that p orbital, which is a symmetrical p orbital, which gives me equal amounts of retention and inversion products. And so the stereochemistry of an SN1 reaction is that I see equal opportunity from above and below the plane, such that if I look at just a simple reaction that has a stereocenter, and I treat this with methanol and sulfuric acid, that what I wind up getting is a racemic product. And this is where I use the wiggly bond to represent that now I'm getting 50-50 mixture. And that single enantiomer when it reacts and goes through a carbocation becomes a racemic product on the backside. Or in this case, if I have more than one stereocenter, they become diastereomers and it becomes a mixture of diastereomers. And so lots more to look at in terms of what happens with stereochemistry when we go through a carbocation, that the carbocation impacts the stereochemistry in a much different way than what the SN2 does. SN2 just inverts it, and we can always count on that inversion. But what happens in an SN1 is slightly more complicated and slightly more messy because we get equal opportunities from above or below in terms of the chemical reaction. So there's our stereochemistry, and we'll pick it up from there when we come back next week. All right. Take care, everyone.